You cannot live here without accepting your place in the food chain.
There's no 911 out here.
Only the tough survive, man.
Life Below Zero. New episodes Thursdays at 9.
Alaska is a big state with an even bigger mythology. The last frontier, America's great wilderness, which might explain the recent outbreak of reality TV shows sensationalizing everything from life on the Yukon River.
For weeks, villagers in Tamina have prepared for a flood that's wreaking havoc upriver.
To the brutal work of commercial fishermen in the Bering Sea.
This is one of the most dangerous things that we do is when we're setting gear. This is where you get jerked over the side.
It is kind of irresistible to mythologize this place. Most of the state is unsettled, covered with mountains and tundra, and the people here have a reputation for being self-reliant and tough. The descendants of trappers, hunters, and frontiersmen. People who survived. So it's tempting to view everything, even something as boring as, say, a train, through the lens of high-stakes adventure.
Living out here, the Alaska Railroad's damned important.
You're in a life-and-death situation. People pay a price to get out of the woods.
All aboard!
Show him your ID. There's your ticket.
This is Harry Ross, the conductor of the train that's featured on that particular reality show. He's the longest-serving employee of the railroad at almost 50 years. And today, he's picking up passengers at Talkeetna, about 100 miles north of Anchorage.
Here's a picture ID from jail.
What?
To show that who I am.
You getting on my train? Hey, and straight out of jail?
Yeah. No, I'm free. That's from months ago.
What did you do?
Oh, it was...
Because I don't want to know if I want to get my club out.
Charges were dropped.
Okay.
The train is not as crazy as it looks on television. Without a soundtrack of churning strings, it's actually pretty pleasant. But Harry has seen a lot go down.
Oh, it's been lots of crazy things happen on the train.
That's because the train is one of the last flag stop services in the country. We are rolling through territory so remote that you can't get to it by road. So when a person waves down the train at any point along the track, it has to stop. And lots of interesting folks end up on board.
I picked up a guy here up here at Namana, where we're headed towards now, and he had his pistol with him, and we had a whole train full of Japanese people on, and he just decided he was going to show them how to shoot, and he started shooting out the window, pow, 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 pow. You know, I'm going, what's going on here? You know,
it strikes me that this may be the last place in America where a train is sort of like the lifeblood of the people that live off of it. You're kind of it.
That's correct. They depend on the railroad a lot.
The folks who live out here are homesteaders, hunters, gold miners. Quite a few of them are Vietnam vets, Harry says. The train is slowing to a stop to make a delivery of dog food to a remote cabin.
Hey, bud.
A scruffy man greets us. He wears sunglasses and has a long beard.
You have to feed your dogs.
Thank you.
You guys can hang with
me.
You can't hang with me.
I'm lonely up here.
If you were so lonely, you wouldn't have been here.
No kidding.
Mountains beyond mountains surround this cabin by the train tracks. It's hard to imagine living in a place so cold and isolated and removed from civilization, but it does have its benefits. You can't get much closer to the natural world.
Northern Lights have been great. These trees right here, the Northern Lights were so narrow and fast, it made it look like the tops of the trees were just doing this gigantic dance. It was amazing. Almost like acid.
Your dog knows that dog food's in there.
I know, he's been hungry. See you later.
Okay.
Well, most of those people that do that, they live out in the woods where they don't want to be bothered. The one guy that we stopped and he was expecting an engine for his snow machine, well, that was Jimmy James. And Jimmy James, he can't go to town because he's a rebel rouser. So most of the people that live in the outskirts, they want to be away from everyone.
We continue north through the Alaskan wilderness. It's otherworldly. We glide across the tundra, then over narrow bridges that cross rocky chasms. Sometimes moose gallop alongside the train. We pull into Fairbanks a couple hours later.
We'd all like to thank you for riding the Alaska Railroad, and welcome to Fairbanks.
It's dark and cold. 22 degrees below zero. Cold. I'm from Florida, and let me tell you, I have no idea why human beings would want to live in 20 degrees below zero. But whatever, we're here. We've traveled here from Anchorage, the biggest city in the state, which people in Fairbanks jokingly call Los Anchorage. But the joking goes both ways. Folks in Anchorage sometimes call Fairbanks the city on the edge of nowhere. Fairbanks is kind of an outpost, just 120 miles from the Arctic Circle, and the biggest city in the whole Alaska interior. It's been native hunting ground, a frontier trading post, a gold rush town, and a major stop on the Trans-Alaskan oil pipeline. People here, like the people we met on the train, live close to the wilderness, right on the brink of it. The landscape shapes their identity and sense of community in some pretty interesting ways. And as scary and hostile and freezing as this place is seeming to me right now, well, I guess it's just a matter of perspective.
You drop me in the middle of New York City, I wouldn't last a day. I'd be dead. End of story. Either get run over by a taxi cab or be in the wrong part of town and somebody, you know, take me out.
If you look up badass in the dictionary, you'll see a picture of John Schandelmeyer. He grew up on a homestead in Alaska.
Killed a moose when I was 7 years old by myself. I was out in the woods by myself and I was sent hunting. And I killed a moose, and that was the first moose I ever shot, and we use moose every year since.
Like many Alaskans, John lived close to nature, and he still does. He runs Crazy Dog Kennels outside of Fairbanks with his wife, Zoya Denure.
And the dogs are getting ready to get hooked up onto a sled, and they are so excited. Like they remind me of my dog when I'm about to take him for a walk, and he's just jumping up and down, ready to go.
These dogs are friendly, but they're not like your average house pet. They've been bred to run. It's wired deep into their brains.
He doesn't just like to go, he's crazy to go. I mean, he's jumping up and down, he's screaming, he's biting the lines, pulling on the lines. He's like something comes loose, screws loose. And that's the screw we like to see loose.
And then, once all 12 dogs are hooked up on the line, I wish you were here with me. Riding behind these dogs to the Alaskan outback is like, it's like being a character in The Call of the Wild. It almost makes me forget the cold. Almost. Dog sledding is big here in Alaska. And its roots stretch back to the frontier days when dog sleds were used to deliver mail, firewood, equipment, furs, and other necessities. Sledding was functional, a way to get supplies from the trading post to the interior, but it quickly became a competitive sport.
You know, it's like people, anybody that has a horse, you know, my horse is faster than your horse, right? My turtle's faster than your turtle. My frog can jump further than your frog, right? And so dog racing began. As soon as people had dogs, I'm sure they were racing them.
John's been racing for decades. He's covered thousands and thousands of miles of wilderness with his dog team in pretty grueling conditions.
Days and nights mean nothing. You know, you think about dog mushing in Alaska in December, it's pretty dark. See that thing over there, that headlamp? We live in those. You know, people always think, well, what do you do at night? Well, we do the same thing at night we do in the day. There's no difference. We're traveling.
For John, running these dogs is about a lot more than racing. He respects these animals because he knows that survival in the Alaskan wilderness was tied to them. And so he's more interested in changing the culture of the sport and the way people train and treat their dogs.
30 years ago, if I was running a dog race, you'd see a whip or what they call a jingler. A jingler is just something that makes noise that I can shake because the dog knows when I shake that it makes a noise and he was going to get a whipping.
Now it's rare for racers to actually whip their animals, but it is common for kennels to discard dogs that aren't fast enough or social enough or who learn too slowly. John and Zoya take in as many of these dogs as they can and rehabilitate them.
A guy had dropped off a dog at the dog shelter, said she was just too, he wrote too slow on the little piece of paper, and we ended up picking her up, and she wasn't the fastest little thing, but she could go, and she enjoyed going, and so John ran her in the quest that year, and he ended up passing that guy, and John said, hey, yo, and he waved to the guy and said, hey, look who's in my team, and the guy was like, he wasn't real happy about it, and I was at the banquet in Whitehorse, and John brought that little dog up on the podium and just said, hey, this dog should have been given a little bit more time and consideration. She's a sweet dog, and she was. She was very outgoing. Her tail was wagging. She was all happy.
It's what we say is a fast food mentality. Here's a dog. He doesn't work today. Huh, get another one. There's tons of dogs out there. So we don't do that.
Ha, 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 Jemmy, ha. Good dog.
Back out on the trail, John is training the dogs for a couple upcoming races. Zoya hopes to enter the Iditarod this year or next. To get the dogs ready, they don't use any physical discipline, just repetition and positive reinforcement.
Leader is not up front with your other leader, it's in the back.
Crazy Dog Kennels is in an interesting position, one that's pretty unique among Alaskan kennels. They want to race and to race competitively, but not for the glory of winning.
I would like to see people running races for the dogs rather than for the place. You know, it's a very difficult concept because racing in itself, we look at winning. But there's only one winner in Iditarod. There's one winner and there's 65 losers, if you look at it that way. So why are you running?
She could go pretty fast, and so we'll let her concentrate on her speed and keeping the team tight.
It's the dog that's important, the animal you're working with, not where you place in the race.
But the race is the only visible venue where Crazy Dog Kennels can make their point. When their teams do well, the racing world sees that you can treat your dogs with care and patience and still compete.
We're seeing what we want to see with the young dog. She's kind of taking charge. Now you see this team moving more like they should. Nice and steady. Good leader up there.
There's hope for these dogs, but you got to have time and patience. Not everybody is going to have that. And not everybody's going to have the patience all the time. That's what we do.
John Chandemeyer competed in the Yukon Quest this year, a 1,000-mile race. He came in fifth out of 18 racers with a team of rehabilitated dogs. Coming up on State of the Reunion, we'll explore the history of a murder that still divides the Fairbanks community nearly 20 years after it happened. Stay with us.
When you become a sustaining member of WILL, you feel great about providing ongoing financial support to your local NPR and PBS stations. As a sustainer, you never receive renewal notices in the mail, and you get exclusive perks. Most importantly, you make a real difference for this station and for this community. It's easy to sign up, even if you've never pledged before. Call 1-800-898-1065 or visit willpledge.org. Thank you.
Support comes from the Champaign Park District, presenting Lyle Lovett and his large band at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign on Saturday, September 6th at 7:30 p.m. More information is available at the Virginia Theater box office, 356-9063, or online at thevirginia.org.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson. Alaska has been a part of our country for more than 50 years, but for thousands of years before that, Native Alaskans called the territory home. The state still has one of the biggest Native populations in the U.S., and a lot of them live in isolated, self-sustaining villages in the far corners of the state. But more and more Alaskan Natives are moving into urban areas, and tensions can result when communities from very different backgrounds collide. Our next story explores that dynamic.
So we're in Fairbanks, Alaska, downtown on the corner of 9th and Barnett. It's a cold winter night. And it was at this intersection back in 1997 where a young man, 15 years old, was found beaten, barely hanging on to life.
Emma's crew states he's a critical trauma patient, a possible scene. They don't know if it's an assault or a hit and run or what.
Nobody saw what happened to this young man, John Hartman. But when he passed away the next day, the investigation into who murdered him, well, it still divides Fairbanks today. SoChu producer Delaney Hall explores his 17-year-old mystery.
John Hartman's body was discovered at the end of a pretty wild night in Fairbanks. Permanent fund checks had just come in. Those are the payments that Alaska residents receive every year based on oil earnings from the state. That meant folks were out having a good time. On top of that, there was a big wedding going on downtown. Two young people with ties to nearby Native villages were getting married, and guests had traveled from all over the region to attend.
you know, we would cut the cake and it was like, oh my goodness, how am I going to serve all these people cake? That's what I was thinking, you know.
This is Annette McCotter. It was her sister Audrey's wedding.
It was packed in that hall in the reception, and it was like, you know, we didn't invite all those people. It was just, for us in the Native community, you know, you don't chase people out. You know, everybody's welcome, and it was just a good time.
But in the days that followed, as the news of Hartman's murder spread, a dark cloud hung over the wedding. The Fairbanks Police Department had arrested and charged three young Native Alaskans and one white teen with the killing. The four were recent graduates of a predominantly Native high school in town, and all of them had attended the wedding reception that night.
Like saying our guests were murderers, I was in disbelief.
The brutal crime shook the town. Journalist Brian O'Donohue was working at the local newspaper when it happened.
A white kid found around the corner from the police station, unconscious and beaten on the street. And then when a group who are characterized as a bunch of Native kids are arrested for it, whatever kind of simmering cultural divides there are kind of come out.
Here's a little background on what happened that chaotic night. After discovering John Hartman's body, police picked up 17-year-old Eugene Vent, who'd reportedly assaulted a motel clerk. After hours of questioning, without a lawyer present, Vent confessed to Hartman's beating and implicated three other young men he knew from his high school basketball team, George Fries, Kevin Pease, and Marvin Roberts. That same day, 20-year-old George Fries showed up at a Fairbanks emergency room with a hurt ankle. He'd been in a fight he claimed he was too drunk to remember. By sundown, the detectives had Fries's confession, too. Both Vent and Fries later retracted these confessions. Three of the young men accused of the murder had juvenile records, but the fourth, Marvin Roberts, was an honors student. He'd never been in serious trouble, and his arrest set off alarm bells in Native villages across the interior. Hazel Roberts, Marvin's mom, remembers hiring a lawyer for him and needing $10,000 for a down payment.
So we would call the villages, Ruby and Tanna, where Marvin is from, and that afternoon at 5 o'clock, there was an envelope out at the airport with almost $14,000. All family, friends, everybody that believed Marvin was innocent.
The fact that the Native community rallied so quickly says something about how tight-knit it is, but it also says something about their prevailing attitude towards the police, who are generally looked at with some suspicion.
I just don't have no faith in this justice system. It's just so sad. They're supposed to be there to help. No, they're not.
Legal battles continued through 1998. All four men were convicted in 1999, and they're currently serving sentences ranging from 33 to 79 years. But the controversy surrounding the Hartman case hasn't gone away. The so-called Fairbanks Four still say they're innocent, even after exhausting all their appeals. And to this day, a sizable part of the Alaska Native community believes that anti-Native bias and shoddy police work resulted in the convictions.
Okay, this is it. This is the original version of the letter that got me involved in this. Faxed to us from the village of Tanana. This letter is about the interrogations and convictions of the four young men charged in the beating death of John Hartman, October 11, 1997. In reading the transcripts of the interrogations, the impression is the four men knew nothing about the murder. Two were drunk and questioned for an...
Here's Brian O'Donohue again. He was working as the opinion page editor at the Fairbanks News Miner a few years after the Hartman murder. And he kept getting these letters from people out in the Native villages around Fairbanks, raising questions about the case.
Too many people in positions of authority and law laugh at these words, double standard of justice, but the Natives know how it is to have lived under it.
It wasn't just the letters. There were protests, too. The Tanana Chiefs Conference, a consortium of 42 villages in interior Alaska, issued a resolution every year calling for the case to be reinvestigated. So Brian decided to leave the newspaper for a job in the journalism department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He wanted time to investigate the lingering questions about what exactly happened to John Hartman. He thought he could involve students in the research and put to rest some of the Native community's concerns about the case. The exact opposite happened.
every single time we followed something that should have given you confidence in the verdicts. When we got there, it no longer inspired confidence in the verdicts.
In 2008, about 10 years after the convictions, Brian published a series in the Fairbanks News Minor called Decade of Doubt. The articles didn't offer proof of guilt or innocence, but they carefully documented gaps in the police investigation. They raised questions about fabricated evidence, possibly coercive interrogation tactics, the police department's failure to pursue other suspects, and the reliability of an eyewitness named Arlo Olson, who was central to the state's case against the Fairbanks Four. The Fairbanks Police Department declined to talk with us about the details of the case, since it's currently under review by the state. But in past reports, they've stood by their investigation.
Here's a flashlight for you. I got one more for ourselves.
Tonight, Brian is out with some students in front of the Eagles Hall, where the wedding reception was held back in 1997. He brings students here most years on the anniversary of the murder. They're testing Arlo Olson's claims.
We need a victim. Who wants to be the victim? Okay, we need four muggers.
Arlo was at the wedding reception that night, and he testified that he'd seen the four murder suspects jump another guy just minutes before the Hartman assault. In the trials, police characterized this mugging as the beginning of a crime spree that ended with Hartman's death. Arlo said that Marvin Roberts was driving the car used in the assault.
And so this is a pretty crucial witness vantage point that we're going to actually pace off and demonstrate.
The mugging happened 550 feet away from where Arlo stood. That's almost two football fields. On top of that, Arlo was drunk. It was late at night and very dark. In interviews with detectives, no one else standing outside the Eagles Hall at the time said they saw anything. And from here, the students who've paced off the distance look like indistinct silhouettes.
And in this instance, we had a lot of folks from the Native community just jumping up and down saying nobody can see what he says that he saw.
Something else bothered the Native community. Arlo's testimony directly contradicted multiple testimonies by other people who'd been at the reception and claimed they'd been with Marvin Roberts at the time of the assault. The fact that the jurors chose to believe Arlo, a Native testifying against other Natives, instead of multiple Native witnesses testifying in support of the accused men, well, it just felt like bias. And then there was the way Prosecutor Jeffrey O'Brien characterized the alibi witnesses, comparing them to rebellious slaves in the 1960 movie Spartacus.
And the leader of the uprising apparently was Spartacus. And when the people in charge of the slaves went down into the work area asking for Spartacus, much like the alibi witnesses here, I am Spartacus, the person behind him. I am Spartacus, the person behind him. I am Spartacus.
This is a recording of O'Brien's closing argument, which has become one of the first things people point to as an example of anti-Native prejudice in the case. Many folks said that O'Brien used this scene to imply that Natives stick together, that they'd be willing to lie for each other.
I am your alibi, because you gave me a ride. No, I am your alibi, because you went to the store for pop. No, I am your alibi, because we danced. And on and on.
Alaska Innocence Project.
Bill Oberle is the executive director of the Alaska Innocence Project, an organization that works to identify people who've been wrongly convicted. He's currently the lawyer for three of the four men in prison for the Hartman murder. He's investigated cases all over Alaska, from Ketchikan to Barrow, and he's seen the way that cross-cultural miscommunication can play out in the justice system.
Native Alaskans are taught to respect their elders, not disagree with people in authority, and if you apply that to the justice system, it doesn't work. I mean, I shake in fear of how many false confessions have been taken from Alaska Natives that we'll never know about.
Bill became aware of the Hartman case in 2008. He was struck by the number of times the case had ended up in court because of potential problems with the investigation. He started digging deeper and eventually heard rumors about a guy serving a double life sentence in California for an unrelated murder. So Bill had his client, Marvin Roberts, write him a letter.
It said, I'm sitting in jail for a crime I didn't commit. It's impacted me and my family, and I understand you might have some information about that crime. I'd urge you to get a hold of my lawyer. And much to my surprise, got a letter back from just saying, give me a phone number, I want to call.
It turns out this guy, William Holmes, wanted to confess to John Hartman's beating. He says it wasn't the guys currently in jail. It was him and four of his friends, including a man named Jason Wallace. In his affidavit, Holmes described going into downtown Fairbanks to harass intoxicated Native Alaskans, something they'd done before and something that police reports verify happens with some regularity. The group went after one Native guy who ran away.
So they got back in the car and saw a white male walking down the street, pulled over, four guys got out to harass him, and before Holmes could park the car and get out, the four were back and said that Jason Wallace had kind of gotten out of control and kicked the guy and done significant injury.
So it was just an instance of John Hartman being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yes, that's correct. That's the way it was described.
The Alaska Innocence Project submitted a petition for post-conviction relief in September 2013, asking the state to reconsider the case given the new confession. But as it turns out, the Fairbanks Police Department was already aware of this confession. Back in 2011, about 8 months before William Holmes got in touch with Bill Oberle, Holmes confessed to a prison officer in California who sent the information to the Fairbanks police. The police considered the Hartman case closed, over a decade old, and they didn't follow up on Holmes, beyond forwarding the information to the district attorney's office. Now the Innocence Project's petition for post-conviction relief is in the hands of Adrienne Bachman, the reviewing prosecutor for the state. She's sifting through all the documents and records associated with the case, and she's looking into the legitimacy of Holmes's confession.
Is it possible that he's mistaken about those things that he's recollecting? Why in the world he would keep this to himself for 16 years? All of those things have to be investigated.
Adrienne has heard the arguments about anti-Native bias over the years, and she doesn't give them much credence, like when it comes to the possibility of cross-cultural miscommunication in the interrogations.
Over the last 27 years, I have certainly read transcripts and listened to interviews where that phenomenon has occurred. In these interviews,
she means the ones with Eugene Vent and George Fries,
there was no deference. There was defiance, there was anger, there was cursing, and this was by the person being interviewed, not by the police officer.
And she's not really buying the Spartacus argument either. In fact, she thinks the charges of racism might be making the case harder to resolve.
The Spartacus speech has taken on an ethnic tone that didn't exist in the original speech. It's not helpful to closure for any of the constituencies who are interested in the outcome of this case.
But unfortunately, the William Holmes confession has only made the case more racially complicated than ever. Holmes, an African American, described going downtown to look for natives in particular. April Monroe Frick shuffles through a pile of letters she's received from the Fairbanks Four over the years.
This one's from Eugene, just kind of random. I saw the pictures of the march. It always really inspires me, gives me the strength to keep going. There are a lot of people there.
April was 16 years old when John Hartman was murdered. She knew all the guys who were convicted, and she now runs a popular blog called Free the Fairbanks 4. William Holmes' confession still needs to be investigated, but it feels right to her. The random victimization of Native kids, especially downtown, was a pretty common occurrence when she was growing up. It even had a name, Native Rolling.
You know, jump out, beat them up. If they had money, if they had anything on them, take it. Throw eggs, stuff dirt in their mouth, snow in their mouth, you know, scrape their face on the pavement. It wasn't unusual for this to happen. It was unusual for this to happen to a Caucasian kid. And talk about, like, send a chill to your bone to think John Hartman died because he was mistaken for being Native. Or really, he died for walking around in Indian territory.
On May 15th, the state responded to the Innocence Project's petition for post-conviction relief. The state opposes the claims of innocence, emphasizes the evidence for the convictions, and dismisses Holmes's confession as hearsay, since he claims he drove the car that night but didn't actually witness Hartman's assault. The case now enters a period of discovery and research, with the state and the Innocence Project each gathering information to support their claims. It's likely that there won't be a hearing for at least 6 months. Whatever the result, it's clear the effects of John Hartman's murder will echo for much longer. For example, the Alaska Native community remains deeply suspicious of the Fairbanks Police Department.
My name is Laren Zager, that's Z-A-G-E-R, Chief of Police of the Fairbanks Police Department, and have been so coming up on 5 years now.
Chief Zager took over the force a dozen years after Hartman's death. He doesn't trace this sense of Native mistrust of the police to the Hartman case in particular, but he does acknowledge that it exists. And so he's been working to diversify the police force, which currently employs no Alaska Natives.
It's a sharing of power. When people can see someone of their own gender or of their own race or their own culture or their own religion that is carrying a badge and a gun, that they feel like they're a part of that community.
With that in mind, the police department has partnered with a local Native organization to fund up to 3 positions for qualified Native officers. But filling those positions has been hard, even though they've recruited heavily across the region.
From that, we got not a single Alaska Native application, not one.
For the Native people we spoke with, that's not really a surprise. Here's blogger April Monroe Frick again.
I think that a lot of people would feel that that was signing up to victimize your own people. And I think a lot of people would feel that it was traitorous. As an institution, you're talking about an institution that came and took 4 people's children 17 years ago, and we're having to pry them out of their hands.
To read more coverage of the John Hartman case, which is complex and continues to evolve, visit our website at stateoftheunion.com. Next up, the sounds of Denali and a battle over wood stoves. Stay with us. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
On the next Fresh Air, as many people hit the road for the holiday weekend, John Waters will talk about his adventures when he recently hit the road with his thumb out, hitchhiking cross country. His book about hitchhiking is called Carsick. Waters directed the films Hairspray, Crybaby, and Pink Flamingos. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping clients achieve their retirement income goals since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Edson, and today we are in Fairbanks, Alaska. The wilderness out here is so vast that it sometimes feels untouchable, like humans couldn't possibly alter it. But what if I told you that the city of Fairbanks has air pollution worse than Los Angeles? Worse sometimes than Beijing? Crazy, right? Well, it's true. Our next story explores why and how this region's strong values of self-reliance and individualism sometimes run up against the limits of the landscape. So True producer Eric Jones tells the story.
The only time I need to split wood mostly now is if I just want to make some smaller kindling pieces.
Jean Olson lives in North Pole, a suburb of Fairbanks. She's out chopping wood on this cold April day, getting ready to load up her wood stove. It's beautiful out here. It feels almost rural.
Moose come and go all year long through here and browse on the willows and the birches. Very lovely, very lovely. Except for one thing.
That one thing is the thick cloud of brown-black smoke that hangs over this area on bad air days. It's even earned the area a nickname.
Basically, we call it the Triangle of Death.
One of the reasons the air is so bad here is a fluke of geography. Fairbanks and North Pole are surrounded by hills. When temperatures drop, the pollution in the valley can get trapped under a layer of warmer air, like a pot with a lid on tight. Then there's the fact that thousands of families still rely on wood stoves because they're the cheapest and most reliable way to heat in this frigid climate. And also, there's the do-it-yourself principle of the thing.
They're proud of the fact that they're almost at a subsistence level where you can get your own food, you can hunt, you can fish, you can garden, you can heat your own place by cutting your own wood. And so for the government to tell people how you can keep warm just doesn't set right with people.
This question of regulation has become a divisive issue in Fairbanks over the past few years, raising all kinds of questions about the role of government and what it means to be a good neighbor in a frontier community. And it all started with an elementary school called Wood River. Back in 2008, when the recession hit, energy prices skyrocketed, and lots of people started turning to wood to heat their homes. We're getting a tour from school counselor Dawn Brashear.
There are some days when the smoke would come up behind that duplex and just roll down the roof, and then this is the first grade playground.
Around 2008, two neighbors across the street from the school put in outdoor wood boilers. They're kind of supersized backyard wood burners that are known for producing a lot of smoke. And Dawn remembers exactly when the smoke got really out of control. It started seeping inside the building. There was even haze in the hallways.
The staff and I, we were all like, what's going on? Why is the fire alarm not going off? There's a fire in the building? And, you know, the kids were like, my eyes hurt, my throat hurts.
The Wood River staff wasn't sure what to do. They learned that local government had few regulations on the books and no enforcement authority. Eventually, they figured out that they could file complaints with the state's Department of Environmental Conservation, which they did again and again.
And we kind of thought that, okay, we made a complaint, so they're going to come out and check on us or investigate it or take some action. And nothing was happening.
This dragged on for 4.5 years until finally the state sued on behalf of the school and the neighbors were forced to stop burning. By then, though, Dawn had developed a chronic sinus infection, even had to have surgery. And the Wood River problem had become news, drawing attention to air quality issues all across the city.
Tough Alaskan kids. Recess is up to 20 below.
Carrie Dershin's son has asthma, and he started having trouble at recess. He goes to Watershed School, a few miles from Wood River.
Most days, he would need his inhaler after they had done 2 or 3 laps running around the school.
Carrie discovered that the air around Watershed was regularly worse than at Wood River. So she started talking with school officials and coming out to public meetings about air pollution. A small clean air movement was building, largely led by concerned parents like Carrie. Now, not long after the smoke problem started at Wood River, something happened at the federal level that complicated matters. The Environmental Protection Agency said Fairbanks was in violation of the Clean Air Act for high levels of an air pollutant called PM2.5. Those are tiny particles that can travel deep into our respiratory tracts, causing asthma, heart disease, stroke, all kinds of nasty stuff. The EPA was basically saying that wood stoves had become a serious health threat that needed to be cleaned up. But in a place like Fairbanks, a lot of people don't look kindly on the federal government getting involved, especially in matters related to hearth and home.
We are the last frontier.
Enter Tammy Wilson, who was then a member of the Fairbanks Borough Assembly.
That's what we do. We take care of each other and ourselves, and we don't need government coming in and helping us. Because, you know, they're just not much of a help.
In 2010 and 2012, Tammy proposed and helped pass 2 laws that effectively banned the local government from enacting any wood-burning regulations. She says it's unfair to punish everyone when really it's just a few bad actors who caused the problems.
And for those, we have laws to where you can't burn black things, you can't burn tires. And literally, I have knocked on more doors than I can tell you to help people when I see that happening. And it literally is knocking on the person's door and just talking to them.
This pretty much sums up Tammy's prescription for dealing with air quality in Fairbanks. No more regulations, just knocking on doors, educating people, being a good neighbor. But the wood stove issue was about to become more heated, excuse the pun. When Tammy's proposition passed, the issue basically bounced back to the state. Now they had to come up with a plan for how to bring the city into EPA compliance. The state's new rules might even mean wood-burning bans on the very coldest winter days. And it was in January 2014, at a meeting to collect public comment about the plan, that the conflict over PM 2.5 hit a low point.
And welcome to this Tuesday edition of Problem Corner. We've got an hour of live local talk on the way.
Stirring the pot, shaking it up. When the
status quo. Tammy appeared on a couple of local talk radio shows on January 7th, the same day of the meeting. She encouraged her anti-regulation constituents to come out and make the case against wood-burning bans. And there were a few moments on air when these conversations got a little unneighborly, implying a dangerous, slippery slope of regulation.
Where does it stop?
It doesn't.
You may go take a long walk off a short pier into a frozen pond and have a nice car dropped on your head, as far as I'm concerned, because you're not going to regulate me.
It's our freedom.
458 Talk is the number. We're going to take a little break here to hear the Fox.
Tammy says she was just trying to get people fired up so they'd come out to a meeting that had been poorly advertised. But Carrie Dershin and other clean air activists say these radio appearances helped set the tone for the meeting that night.
There was a woman who spoke about her health impacts. She shared about how she could not go into town on certain days when the air was bad. She was booed at that meeting.
Other pro-regulation commenters got heckled too. People shouted that they should move away if they didn't like it in Fairbanks.
It really broke it down to like, okay, if we have people that are booing and jeering, how does that set us up from neighbors to neighbors having that dialogue?
It's been more than 4 months since that meeting, and the state has yet to share its implementation plan with the community. But in the meantime, Tammy's call for neighborly conversation has been a kind of challenge. In Fairbanks, a place so forbidding that there's little margin for error, the only value is deeply rooted as self-reliance might be the responsibility people feel to help their neighbors. So despite the tone that night, some people have decided to go knock on doors. Today, Jean Olson is attempting an experiment. Remember her, the woodcutter we met at the beginning of the story? Well, she's identified the worst polluters in her North Pole neighborhood, and she and some friends on both sides of the issue are going to pay them a visit. They've been warned people could get angry, even violent, but they're hoping to work it out, neighbor to neighbor.
Howdy.
An older woman opens the door, and she's a little resistant at first.
So this will get you a really efficient wood stove that will burn much better than a cook stove would burn, so you use a lot less wood.
We don't want to change our cook stove.
Okay. So you could, if that's...
But they keep chatting about the city's wood stove changeout program, and as it turns out, a few weeks later, the woman signs up for it. She and her husband will be getting a more efficient stove soon. It might seem like one small victory in a valley filling up with smoke, but Jean says the approach is uniquely Alaskan. Independent neighbors helping independent neighbors follow the rules.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks. Sorry you're freezing.
Sorry about the house. Sorry.
Denali, which means high one in Athabaskan, towers over the Alaska interior. It's the tallest mountain in North America, and it sits in the middle of Denali National Park and Preserve, one of the biggest stretches of wilderness left in the country. It's also one of the last places in the world where you'd expect to find noise pollution, which is threatening to drown out the natural sounds of the park.
We'll be winding our way up this footpath we've put in, heading into back up into the sunny area on top.
This is David Bechkal. He looks like he time-traveled here from the Klondike Gold Rush days. He has the biggest beard I've ever seen, and he's leading us up a hill through knee-deep snow to one of his recording stations. There are about 10 of these scattered across millions of acres of parkland.
And we are now looking over the valley that the Park Road winds through on its way to Savage River.
As a soundscape technician, David studies the sonic environment of the park. These recorders are like his ears, ears that occasionally get gnawed on by wild animals.
You name it, it's happened. Porcupines have chewed off the lids, bears have pulled entire stations on the order of about 30 or 35 meters. They've almost fallen into rivers.
David's recording stations allow him to eavesdrop on Denali, to hear what goes on when he's not around. He's picked up the sound of a willow ptarmigan, Alaska state bird, and a caribou herd, known for the delicate clicking of their ankle joints. The recorder even caught the sound of that bear trying to drag it away.
Oh,
Since 2001, the park has captured and analyzed more than 20,000 hours of these recordings, and it's David's job to figure out what a healthy and an unhealthy landscape sounds like.
A lot of my job has to do with trying to figure out what we should do about noise and how it impacts your ability to appreciate natural solitude and natural sounds.
That's because increasingly, David's recorders pick up this kind of sound. Small airplanes, flying low, sometimes buzzing overhead as many as 78 times a day. Just like, say, air pollution or light pollution, this sonic pollution affects the park environment. And that can be a problem for wildlife. Take the Arctic ground squirrel. They communicate with each other via squeaks when there's a predator in the area.
The ground predator call has sort of like a beep or a chee-chee-chee. And then the aerial predator call, which a lot of times golden eagles are feeding on ground squirrels, and they have kind of like a whee or a whee.
But if there's a plane flying overhead that drowns out the sound of the warning squeaks, it's goodbye, Mr. Squirrel. And that's just one example. Noises can also affect breeding, hunting, and migration. But we, humans, I mean, lose something too when we pollute Denali's soundscape with our racket. We lose the chance to experience the natural world with our ears. We're back up on the ridge with David. Every time he comes to check out a recording station, he likes to take some time at the end to just sit and listen.
Get your things situated in such a way that you don't need to deal with them for a little while. Get all the zippers figured out and blow your nose. I like to sit for at least 5, if I can, longer.
The silence begins. For a few minutes, the only thing we hear is the occasional shuffle of our parkas as we shift in the snow. A few birds calling from the brush. There's time to focus on the pine cones on the top of the spruce, sunlight scattering on the snow.
So when you disrupt attention, you're disrupting your ability to form memories of a place. Paying attention to nature. I mean, if that's not one of the things that Park Service encourages people to do, I don't know what is.
If you can't perceive it, then how can you protect it? I guess that'd be one way to put it.
The first superintendent of the park, Harry Carsons, was actually pretty keyed into that kind of stuff. He said something very interesting. There's much to learn from those who studied the great silent places, the mighty mouth hollows, plumb full of hush to the brim.
And this is one of the last great silent places on Earth. And now, from the foothills of Denali, we head up into the sky. Everywhere we travel, we ask a writer to pen a letter to the place they call home. Today, we hear from a former bush pilot.
Dear Fairbanks, before we met, all I knew of aviation was the classroom, the endless practice of stalls and touch and goes, the politics of aircraft noise. From you, I learned that flying was also a team of sled dogs restless on the ramp, pawing at the snow while waiting to be loaded and taken on to their next race. It was a 5-tiered wedding cake, carefully strapped down for a celebration in the village of Nulato. The standard cargo was 500 pounds of pumpkins for a Halloween party in Ruby, or the rifles, tents, and boxes of food for a hunting party from outside who saved for years to embark on their Alaskan trip of a lifetime. For you, flying with school kids traveling for basketball games, convicts en route to prison in Nome, and U.S. mail that included boxes of live chicks, fully assembled bicycles, truck tires, and cases of pop and potato chips. One sad day, we loaded an ornate casket for Stevens Village, its occupant, a dearly loved elder, finally going home. On that day, aviation was the business of grief. I learned so much from you, Fairbanks, about how flying could make a wilderness seem like a small town. You taught me that 30 below zero is not too cold to fly, nor is 40 below, nor, shockingly, is 50 below. You took me beyond Lindbergh and Earhart, introducing pilots whose exploits were absent from my textbooks. You gave me Ben Eielson, first to cross the Arctic Ocean, Joe Crossan, first to land on a glacier, and Noel Wien, first to cover the Bering Strait. These were your pilots, your stories, your hometown heroes. Aviation is a careful thing, you taught me. Here with you, it can be so dirty and dangerous and unforgiving. but also here with Denali clear in the distance and rivers churning all around us, it can be like no place else on earth. Always, Colleen Mondor.
This really is like no place else on earth. A place where the wilderness still dominates, where everyday life requires a level of grit, determination, and skill you don't see in many other regions. People shape the landscape, as we've heard. But the landscape shapes the people, too.
You are dependent upon each other. If your car breaks down and it's negative 40, how long do you think you're going to be sitting in it before you're frozen? You know somebody's going to stop by and help you. It's that last frontier attitude.
You couldn't take an Alaskan community and put it anywhere else because this environment is so unique and we have built communities around it.
It's not just that kind of rugged individualism and independence. It's the fact that Fairbanks is a town, you know? If it was all about self-reliance and independence, there never would have been a Fairbanks.
Frontier Community was produced by Delaney Hall with help from senior editor Taki Telenitis. The rest of the SoChu staff is producer Tina Antolini and Laura Starcheski and business manager Bree Burge. Our intern crew is Ali Bergerman, Kathy Tu, and Eric Jones. You can see photos from Interior Alaska and listen to our other episodes at stateoftheunion.com. We're on Twitter at SoChu. SoChu is presented by WJCT and distributed by PRX and NPR with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Letson. Remember,